Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Hyperacademic calling Deborah Plant. Dr. Deborah Plant is an African-American literature and Africana studies scholar and is the author of the introduction and afterword for Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon. As a note for listeners, throughout our conversation, Dr. Plant refers to Cujo by his given African name, Kasola. The posthumous first-time publication of Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon, with Cujo's voice recounted in his vernacular, is a seminal moment in American literary, historical, and anthropological documentary culture. Barracoon is on sale May 8th in hardcover from our imprint, Amistad. So this morning on the phone with us, we have Dr. Deborah Plant, an African-American literature and Africana studies scholar and the author of an introduction and afterword of Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon. Deb, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's my pleasure. We don't get what classical slave narratives bring us in terms of this heroic voice that is triumphant and that is all about freedom and freeing others who were still enslaved. Kosla's story is less about freedom in America than it is about a longing to return to his origins in West Africa. And it's not so much a triumphant voice in the sense of what, say, we find in a narrative like that of Frederick Douglass. So we get another side of the story, another experience of the story. And we get a lot of agony in terms of what happens to a human being when that human being is deracinated, uprooted from her or his home. Just what that means and how fragmented a life can become when one is uprooted, torn from one's village, from one's the continent on which one lives, and is forced to leave everything one knows. That's a story. It brings us to an understanding about just how terrorizing that is, how traumatic that is, and it brings this anguish, this pain, this sadness. And even though we can see the resilience in Kosla's life, we still see and feel and experience the depression that he experienced and feel what that did to him, his entire life, how it questioned his sense of self and who he was, his identity. One of the aspects of being a human being is that we have this need to know who we are, this need to know where we belong. And then we get to see, in Kosla's case, what happens to that sense of self when one is so violently, rudely uprooted from one's origins.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, August 24th, 2018. So I have been told this is our third and final study session on Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo. We are picking up on chapter 7. We had an extra break in between sessions because of my teacher training exam last Friday, but that's done. Back on schedule, normal time, finishing the book this week. We will only have one audio segment and then we will be all done. So if you have final thoughts on what we read, now would be the time to share. We heard Deborah G. Plant. She helped collect this book. She wrote the introduction for the text that we already heard. You heard some of her comments in the audio segment just now. I heard that was only a portion of the interview. I am greatly suspicious anytime that I hear this book talked about by an author, particularly if it's somebody who's knowledgeable about this text, white or non-white. If there is no mention of the godmother, suspected race soldier, Charlotte Mason, and the fact that she paid Zora Neale Hurston for this book. She also paid Kasula for contributing to this text, and she had her own motivations for why she wanted this book released. I think that is hugely, maybe the most important bit of information about this text. Miss Mason, the godmother, is mentioned in the dedication for the text. Yeah, that should greatly impact how we process all information in the book. I'll leave it there for now. We're starting in chapter 12, Zora Neale Hurston, Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo, final session on the Cattle's Book Club.
Chapter 12, Alone. One night, Celia wake up in the night and say, "Cudger, wake up. I dream about our children. Look like they cold." I tell her she think too much. Go back to sleep. It hurt in me, cause it a cold night in November in the 1908. And I remember how Celia used to visit the children when they was little to see they got plenty quilts so they keep warm, you understand me? The next day, she said, "Cudgel, come on, lest we go see our children's grave." So I say yes, but I try not to take her, cause I'm afraid she worry about them. So I go in the church and I make it like I'm busy, so she forget it, the graveyard. When I come out to church, I don't see her nowhere, so I look across the hill and I see her in a family lot. I see Silly going from one her children gray to the other, like she covered him up with more quilts. The next week my wife left me. Cause I don't know. She ain't been sick, but she died. She don't want to leave me. She cry cause she don't want me be lonesome. But she leave me and go where her children. Oh, Lord. Lord, the wife, she the eyes to the man's soul. How can I see now when I ain't got it no eyes no more? The next month, my Alec, he died. Then I just like I come from the African soil. I got nobody but the daughter-in-law, Mary, and the grandchildren. I tell you, she my son's wife. So she stay in the compound and she take the land when I go with Celia and our children. Old Charlie, he the oldest one, come from the African soil. One Sunday after my wife left me, he come with all the others to come across the water and say, "Uncle Cudgel, make us a parable." Well, then I say, "You see old Charlie there? Suppose he stop here on the way to church. He got the parasol, cause he think it gonna rain when he leave the house. But he look at the sky and sighed, it ain't gonna rain, so he set it there by the door and go on to church. After the preaching, he go on home, cause he think the parasol at Cudgel house, it's safe. He say, 'I get it next time I go that way.' When he come home, he say to one the chillen, go to Cudjoe house and tell him I say sending me my parasol. The parasol? It pretty. I like it keep, that one. But I asked it them all, is it right to keep the parasol? They all say no. It belong to Charlie. Well, I say, my wife, she belonged to God. He left her by my door. I appreciate my countrymen, they come see me when they know I'm lonely. Another time they come to me and say, Uncle Cudjoe, make us another parable. I bow my head in my hands. Then I lift it up again. Footnote. This is a characteristic gesture when he begins a story. End of footnote. Then I talk. I don't know. Me and my wife, we been riding. I think we go to Mount Vernon. The conductor go to her and say, oh, lady, where you going to get off? She say, Plateau. I look at her. I say, how you say you going to get off at Plateau? I thought you going to Mount Vernon with me. She shake her head. She say, I don't know. I just know I get off at Plateau. I don't want to leave you, but I got to get off at Plateau. The conductor blow once, he blow twice, and my wife, she say goodbye, Cudjoe, I hate to leave you. But she get off at Plateau. The conductor come to me and ask the old man, where you gonna get off? I say, Mount Vernon. I traveling yet. When I get to Mount Vernon, I no talk to you no more. I had spent 2 months with Cazula, who was called Cudjoe, trying to find the answers to my questions. Some days we ate great quantities of clingstone peaches and talked. Sometimes we ate watermelon and talked. Once it was a huge mess of steamed crabs. Sometimes we just ate. Sometimes we just talked. At other times, neither was possible. He just chased me away. He wanted to work in his garden or fix his fences. He couldn't be bothered. The present was too urgent to let the past intrude. But on the whole, he was glad to see me, and we became warm friends. At the end, the bond had become strong enough for him to wish to follow me to New York. It was a very sad morning in October when I said the final goodbye. And look back the last time at the lonely figure that stood on the edge of the cliff that fronts the highway. He had come out to the front of his place that overhangs the Cochrane Highway that leads to the bridge of that name. He wanted to see the last of me. He had saved 2 peaches, the last he had found on his tree, for me. When I crossed the bridge, I know he went back to his porch, to his house full of thoughts, to his memories of fat girls with ringing golden bracelets, his drums that speak the minds of men, to palm nut cakes and bull roarers, to his parables. I am sure that he does not fear death. In spite of his long Christian fellowship, he is too deeply a pagan to fear death. But he is full of trembling awe before the altar of the past. Appendix. Takoi, or Atako, children's game. A memory test game played by 2 players. One player, A, the tester, squats facing the diagram which is drawn on the ground. The other player, whose memory is to be tested, squats with his back to the figure. A grain of corn is placed in each of the 3 circles between the lines. Each of the lines, 1, 2, 3, have a name. Number 1, Akinjo Makini. Number 2, Abaja Lefon. Number 3, Apun Dakre Admejie. A points at line 1 at W, and B says, Akinjo Makini. A points to line 2, and B says, Abaja Lefon. A goes on to line 3 and B says, Apuun dakra admeejie. Then A points to circle one and B says, corn. A removes the grain of corn from the circle and goes back to line one at W. B recites the name again. A goes to line two and three as before, then to circle one. B says, no corn. Then A points to circle two and B says, corn. A removes the corn from circle two and returns to line one, W, two and three, and B gives the names as before. Then A goes to circle one and B says, no corn. To circle two, and B says, no corn. To circle three, and B says, corn. The corn is removed from circle three, and A returns to line one at W, and goes through the three lines and circles as before. Of course, if B remembers that there is no corn in any of the three circles, A then points to line one at X, and B says, Akinjo Makini. And A goes on to lines 2 and 3, and then on to circle 1 between X and Y, and B says, corn. A removes the corn and returns to line at W and goes through the empty circles to lines at X and the empty circle. B says, no corn, and A goes on to the next circle where B says, corn. The corn is removed, then back to line one at W, and the game keeps up until the 12 circles have been emptied of corn, if B's memory is good enough. Another game seems to be akin to both billiards and bowling. Three balls are racked up, and the player stands off and knocks them down with seven balls in his hand. The top ball of the three must be hit last with the seventh thrown ball. Stories Kasula told me. There are no windows in Kasula's house. It was a cold day in December and the door was closed. The little light came from the pine knots in the fireplace. It is crude, but suits his needs very well indeed. There are two pieces of iron slanting slightly upward in each inside wall of the fireplace. It is an African idea, transplanted to America. They are placed there to support the racks for drying fish. Kasula smokes a great deal and taps his pipe quite often. All of his pipes have tops that he has made himself to keep the fire from falling out as he works. The pipe lids are just another of the evidences of the primitive, the self-reliance of the people who live outside the influence of machinery. There is something in the iron pot bubbling away among the coals. We eat some of the stew and find it delicious. It is a sort of stew of all flesh, shredded in some way. Kasula lights his pipe again. You want me to tell you story about Afriki? I done forget all that. I been in America so the 69 year last August. It been so long I have anybody talk with, I forget. You don't be mad with Uncle Cudjo if he forget, baby. I wouldn't hurt your feeling for nothing in this world. I assure him that I can never be angry with him, no matter if he never remembers a word, but praying strongly within that he remembers. We sit for a long time in silence. I tell him a few stories after giving him a chance to think, and he is delighted. Finally, he turns eagerly towards me, his face alight. McGuine, tell you this a story. Three men, you understand me, they agree they ain't gonna tell one on the other. One day, these three men, they say, we ain't got no meat, lest we go in the woods and find a cow invited up. They hunt till they find a fat one, and they kill it. They all get round it. One say, I want a hind leg. Other say, I want a hind leg. Third one say, I want a hind leg. A beaming face is turned to me to see if I get the point that three men can't get a hind leg off of one cow. He is very happy that I appreciate the dilemma in the tale. They gin fight and fight, One say, I kill you. Very expressive gesture of conflict. Other say, I kill you. Very hearty laughter. The struggling gestures continue. Dey fight till they come to the highway, and the officer see them fighting, you understand me? And he say, looky here, what y'all fighting about? One of the men, he say, if you don't fool me, I won't fool you. He asks the other, he say, if you don't fool me, I won't fool you. The third man, he say the same thing. So the officer, he go to the king and say, I found 3 men, they fight. But when I asked them what for they fight, they all say, if you don't fool me, I won't fool you. The king summons them to appear before him, and he say, what's the matter, you 3 men? They all say same thing again, hearty chuckling. Then the king, he say, something they do, they don't want to tell. They is men of strong friendship. Then he give them 10 coats, 10 shoes, 10 of everything, and sent them off. They went back and vied the cow eagle. Mirthy tears ran down the cheeks of Kozula, and he shook with chuckles long after the tale was finished. But he could not be persuaded to tell another that day. You come again Tuesday next week, and I tell you something if I think. But Uncle Cudjo getting old. I've been in the murky soil since 1859, I forgets. On the Tuesday after the New Year, I found Cudjo in a backward-looking mood. He was with his departed family in the land to the west. He talked about his boys. He grew tearful over his wife. I'm so lonely. I lost my wife to 15 November 1908. We've been together a long time. I married her Christmas Day, 1865. She a good wife to me. There was a long, feeling silence. Then he turned on me and spoke. Oh, Charlie, he the oldest one come from Africa. Come one Sunday, after my wife left me, and say, Uncle Cudjo, make us a parable. Then I asked him, how many limbs God give the body so it can be active? They say 6, 2 arms, 2 feet, 2 eyes. I say they cut off the feet, he got hands to fend himself. They cut off the hands, he wiggle out the way when he see danger come. But when he lose the eye, then he can't see nothing come upon him. He finish. My boys is my feet. My daughter is my hands. My wife, she my eye. She left. Cudjo finish. It was 2 o'clock, and Kozula excused himself that he might work on his fence before dark. Come see me when tain't cold. 2 days later, I sat beside his fire in the windowless house and watched him smoke until he was ready to speak. I told him a story or two, and finally he glowed and stirred. It a man, you know. He got a son. 6 men, you understand, they follow him all the time. The long runny, the old man say, son, these men always in your house. You know what 6 men do to you? They don't do nothing to me. That what the son say. And always the 7 men be together till he get grown, and the time come for him to marry. The old man, he want to try these 6 men. So when the son marry, he hide the girl, and then he take a ram, and he kill it and cut off the horns. He fix it and make it look like the girl. Then he say to the boy, go tell your friends that you married a girl last night and she feel dead and I don't want the king to know. And dig a grave. He wants the friends to dig the grave and bury her. Perhaps she was too young and never had known no man. Well, the six men come to dig the grave, but only two stayed to finish dig, and four went spread the news clean till it reached to the king. The king then sent for the old man and said to him, "Your son just married a girl. Where's she?" "She at home," the old man said to the king. And he say, "Where your house? I wants to see." The king goes with him to the house, and he show him the girl. Then he say, "Well, what you bury in the hole?" He say, "The rammer." But the king wants satisfied, and he have to dig up the grave and let the king see the rammer hisself. Then he tell the king how 'tis. "I ask of my boy about these six men, and he say they all right. All the time they sleep and eat and go with him, I won't know they friendship, so I kill her the rammer." The king say, "You have knowledge." And so he paid the two what stay dig the grave and don't say nothing, and killed the four men what talk and betray their friend. The Monkey and the Camel. One day, I tell you this one, the Uthakudum weasel went up the melon tree to eat it hisself some fruit. The camel, he liked melon all the time, so when he see the weasel in the tree, he go ask him, throw him some. The weasel throw him some, then he come down and go in his house. The camel, he still wanted some more melon, so he wait. After a while, the monkey, he go to the melon tree to get him some too. The camel, he hurry up under the tree and say to the monkey, "Give me some of the melons too." And the monkey throw him some. Then he asked the monkey to throw him more, and he eat at that. Then he asked for more and more till the monkey, he get tired. He want to come down from the tree and go home to dinner with his fruit. So he tell the camel he too greedy, and if he want more melon, let him climb the tree himself and get his some. That make the camel mad. So he say that the monkey is a very mouthy animal, with an ugly red behind and very ugly nose. Now the monkey, he know that his nose is ugly, and he is very ashamed for the camel to speak about it. So he say that the camel is a creature with no hind quarters. The camel get it so mad at that, till he reach up the tree and grab the monkey and carry him off. Well, after he walk a while, he meet the rhinoceros and he ask, "Camel, how come you seize the monkey?" The camel say, "Let him tell himself." The monkey, "Well, I was up the melon tree eating some fruit, and the camel come along and ask me throw him some. I did throw him some, and more. But when I was tired and want to go home, he says that I am a beast with ugly nostrils and sunken eyes. And I got very mad, say that the camel is a beast without a rump, and he done seized me and tote me off." The rhinoceros said that the monkey was wrong to speak of the camel so, and told him not to let him go. So the camel carried him on. After a while, they met the leopard and said, "Oh, camel, what make you seize the monkey? Is he done you wrong? Let him tell you hisself what he done." The monkey, "Well, I was up the melon tree eating some fruit, and the camel, he come up under the tree and asked me to throw him down some fruit. Well, I throw him some, then some more, till I get him very tired. Then I say, he is a lazy animal that worries other animals when they go to get fruit. Let him climb the melon tree himself." Then he say, "I am a creature with no manners and a red behind. And I say that he is a beast with no behind at all, and not enough tail to hide the place where his behind ought to be. Then he grab me and bring me here." The leopard say that the monkey was wrong to speak thus of the camel, and that the camel must not let him go. So the camel carried him on. After a while, They come to the house of the weasel, and he was sitting outside the doorway. He seen the camel with the monkey, and he asked the camel, "Oh, camel, how come you seized the monkey? What he done wrong?" The camel say, "Let him tell it hisself." The monkey say, "Well, I was up the melon tree getting fruit for my wife, and the camel come under the tree and ask of me to throw him down some fruit. I done throw him some, then more, till I was tired. And I said he was a greedy beast whose rump looked like he'd been drinking caña, a powerful laxative. And he grabbing me and bring me here." Now the weasel, he feels sorry for the monkey, and he know hisself that the camel is worrisome under the fruit tree. So he said a while, then he say, "I will be the judge twixt you two." And they both say, "All right, you be the judge first." The first thing he say, "You, monkey, come sit here on my right side, and you, camel, sit here on my left, whilst I decide the question." They both done what he say, and he sat there quiet for a while. Then he opened his mouth. "Oh, monkey, I sentence you for speaking so to the camel to leap up that tree whilst I run into my hole." And he done that, and the camel was left sitting where it was. After a while, he went away. Story of the Jonah. "What you want me to talk, Jonah? Who and what kind of prophet is Jonah? I don't know. I couldn't tell you that. God speaking unto Jonah, 'Go tell Nineveh to turn to me, cause they sins it come before me.' Jonah say, 'No, I ain't going.' Jonah say, 'Well, being I here, he gonna torment me. I gonna get away from here.' So he went there, you know, in the vessel ship to go to Joppa, that a country, you know, where God ain't gwine bother him. Listen, cut your say-so, he didn't know it. God is everywhere. And so he went on to the ship to go to Joppa, and God looked at him. God see Jonah in the vessel, and so when he went to the vessel, God looked. Gesture of a penetrating look at him. He see the Jonah there. He see the Jonah there. So God went to the east and, gesturing of unlocking and flinging wide a door, unlocky the storm room, say to the storm, 'Come out.' Hand uplifted in a kingly commanding gesture. And the storm started. Then God went to the west, unlocky another storm room. Gesture. 'Come out. Come out of there.' Then God went to the north, unlocky that storm room, tell it to come out. Then he went to the south, unlocky another storm room and another storm in the south. All storms come meted together. All storms come meted together, and the vessel can go nowhere. Now, what did the captain say? That what I go tell you now. The captain say, 'That's not the first time I go travel in the sea. Something wrong.' And the man say, 'Captain, there's a man in the boat,' and then he pay his fare. The captain say, 'Whereabouts is he?' They say, 'He way down in the bottom of the boat.' He say, 'Go tell him to come here.' I go and tell you what the sailors say when they went down in the bottom of the boat. I go and tell you what they say to Jonah. They say, 'Oh, sleeper, wake up from your sleep and call on your God, else we go perish in the sea.' When he come to the captain on the deck, he say, 'Who you?' He, Jonah, say, 'I'm a Hebrew, done run away from God.' Captain say, 'What must we do now so the sea can become calm?' He say, 'Heave me overboard.' The captain say, 'I ain't gwine do it till we draw the lot. We don't want to be guilty of your blood. They drawed a lot, and the lot fell on Jonah. Looky here. God prepared a whale right alongside of the ship with his mouth wide open. Gesture. When they throw him in, the whale took in, carried him to Nineveh 3 days and 3 nights. When he got to the Nineveh, he heave him on the shore. Ain't no shade in the seashore. So God suffered a gourd vine grow over he head for the shade. Jonah won't go to Nineveh. So God sended a worm and cut a gourd vine, slashing gesture, down, hand lifted straight up. God said, Jonah, your name called. He say to him, go into Nineveh. And when they got there, he say 40 days and 40 nights, and Nineveh shall be overthrowed. And the king say, this is the man of God. 3 days, 3 nights, the cows, the pigs, neither the mules, neither the chickens give him nothing to eat. Nobody eat, neither drink. So Jonah went to the mountain to see how it gonna be overthrow. But instead of that, God blessed him. So then Jonah got mad. Say, Lord, didn't you tell me you gonna destroy that city? God say, Jonah, there's 7,000 women and children in that city don't know right from wrong. If you think I go destroy them, you's crazy. How long Nineveh de blessy? I don't know. That the end right there. That's the fur I can go. Now this Abraham, father the faithful. He had nephew named Lot. Now that's right. Both of them kin folks. They have servant mind to stock what they raise. One day, they two servants, they were quarreling. Abraham say to the Lot, we two kinfolks, these servant, they quarrel. Don't let it that break the friendship. Now, that all right, that's enough. Now, which way you going? Lot say to the Abraham, I going to Sodom and Gomorrah. Where you going? Abraham say, I going to the land of Canaan. When they so much in sin in Sodom and Gomorrah, then the Lord, he took it 2 angels to pass Abraham's tent. Abraham seen them and want to bow to them. And then he went and get kid and dress him and set it before them to eat a dinner. When they get through eating, they start to Sodom and Gomorrah. One the angels say to the other, let's not hide our business from Abraham. Let's tell him where we're going. So they say, Abraham, do you know we going to Sodom and Gomorrah to set it afire, go and burn the place down? So much sin went it before God that God going burn the place out. No, Abraham say, if I find 50 righteous, will you spare the city? The angel say, yes, for your sake. Abraham went to Sodom and Gomorrah and can't find the 50 righteous. If I find the 40 righteous, will you spare the place? They say, yeah, for your sake, we spare them. He fell back to 25 and couldn't find them. When he called for 10, the Lord won't listen. He flee away from him. Then the 2 angels go to Lot's house and tell him, now you leave here and don't look it back. When the people see the daughters of Zion come to Lot's house, they say to Lot, what is they doing there? Lot say, don't bother them. Then the angel pull Lot back and wave the hand, and all the people go blind. Then they say to Lot, you flee away from here just as quick as you can, and don't look it back. Lot's wife look it back and turn to a pillar of salt, and she be dead till judgment day. Poor cudgel, I no look it back. I press it forward. The Lion Woman. three men, they each have a lady. One say, if I live to marry a wife, when she have a son, he go get down on top of an elephant to ride. Another one say, if I live to have a wife, when she have a son, he go get down on top of a zebra for a ride. The third man, he say, if I live to marry this a girl I love, when she have a son, he go get down on top of a lion for a saddle horse. The people, they say, how he gonna do that? He can't do that because before he catch the lion catch him. He say, oh no. Well, he married a girl and they have a son. When they boy, he gets so he can run and throw the spear from the hand, you understand me? The man, he go in the woods and he found two young lions. But they mama, she gonna kill her something for them to eat. So he take it to two lions and kill it one and take it to hide and stretch it on the fence in the garden. The other one, you understand me, he chained by the neck to a tree. The mama lion, she come home and she miss her babies and she know the man take her children. She feel hurty, you understand me. Her breasts swell way like this. She make up her mind she going punish the man for killing her babies. So she turn herself into a woman, and many men see her come into the village. She look very fat and handsome, and all the men want to marry her. She tote a purse here upon her hip. She say she will marry the man that throws something in the purse. Everybody, they chunking at the purse. They chunk and they chunk. Some throw too far. Some don't throw far enough. Nobody make it go in the purse. The man that catches the lions, he stand and looky, but he don't try chunky in the purse. He love his wife, and he don't want no more wife. She watch him, and she ask him, why you no try chunky in the purse? Don't you want me for your wife? He say, I don't want a chunk. I got a wife already. She say, but I want you to chunk. She beg him, please. Till after a while, just so he pick up something with his left hand, throw this away. But it went right in the purse. So she went home with him to his house. Soon she get in the house, she see the skin stretch on the garden fence and see the other one chained to the tree, and she swell up inside of her, and she wish for night to come. She wish it was night that minute. She lay in the bed with the man that night, but she ain't never go to sleep. He go sleep, but she wait to kill him. When she see he sleep, she turned back to a lion and got up walking in the house. The man, he got dogs, you understand me, and they know she a lion, and they know when she get up to kill him. Just when she go to him to tear him up, the dogs bark and say, no, you don't. No, you don't. That's my master. And if and you kill him, you can't cross this yard. We kill you. She come back and lay down with the man and wake him up. She say, husband, I can't sleep. Your dogs make so much noise to keep me awake. I think they going to come in the house and bite me. You better go chain them up. He get up and go chain the dogs like she say. Then he go back to sleep. She get up again, but the dogs hear, and they talk so loud she scared he hear them. So she get back in the bed, and she think what she can do to kill him. In the morning she say to him, I can't stay with you because your dogs, they won't let me sleep. I'm going home this morning. You going peace the way with me? He say he go with her piece away. He go get his hunting spear and his bow and arrow. But she say, what for you take the spear? You mean to kill me on the way? You don't need no arrow neither. He tell her he always take his spear when he go to the woods. But she cry and say she scared he going to kill her. So he put down the weapons. Then he put on his hunting knife. But she make him take that off too. Then he take your whistle, you understand me, and put it in his shirt, and take 9 eggs to eat on the way. Then he go on with her. on the way they talk. She asked him, if a lion jump on you, what you going to do? He say, I turn to a deer and run away fast. Oh, but a lion overtake a deer. Then what you do? Then I turn to a snake and I go in the ground. Oh, but the lion catch you before you dig the hole. Well, then I turn. He start to say he turned to a bird and fly up in the tree. But the voice of his father come to him and say, hush. So he say, I don't know what I do then. After a while, they come to a woods, and the woman excuse herself and go in the bush and stay a minute. Then a big lion come out and take right after the man. He think quick what he going to do, and he turn to a bird and fly up in the highest tree. The lion opened one side and took out 9 men with their axes and opened the other side and take out 9 more and then begin to chop it down the tree. The man, he blown the whistle, so his dogs hear him and come. The men, they chop hard at the tree. The lion, she walk round and round and roar what she gonna do when the tree fall. When the tree begin to fall, the man drop 1 egg, and the tree, it come back up again. He blow and blow for his dog, but they ain't heard him yet. He drop another egg when the tree commenced to fall next time, and he kept on till the last egg it gone. The tree began to shake again, but he blow and blow on his whistle. One young dog say to the other, well, that seem like master's whistle like here, don't you think so? The old dog say, oh, lay down. You always hear something, so you can run in the woods. After a while, the young dog say he hears something again, but the old dog say, no, be quiet. The tree is almost chopped down, and the lion stand on a hind leg so she grab him when he fall. The young dog say again, he hear the whistle, and the old dog say, wait. I believe I hear something, too. Wait a minute. He listen. Then he say, it is Master's whistle. He in trouble, too. Let me go in the house and put the eye medicine in the eye. He go in the house and put the medicine in his eye so that he can see clear across the world. He say, I see, Master, and he in bad trouble. Let's go. They run to the tree faster than anything in the world and killed the lion and all the men. The man flew down from the tree and turned back to himself again. Then the man and the dogs take up all the meat and take it home and throw it in the yard. Then the man, he go in the house with his wife, but he don't tell her nothing, 'cause the old dog, he tell him that if he tell, he will die. When she look in the yard and see all the meat, she say to him, where you get all the meat? And he say, I've been hunting. But he don't tell her that the dogs done made baskets out of plum twigs and brung the meat home. They walk on their hind legs like a man and tote the baskets with their front legs. His wife say, you never brung home all of that meat. No man can tote so much. It too much for one man. You tell me who brung that meat for you. All day she keep that up. Nighttime come, and he won't go to bed. She say no, she not sleep with him never no more unless he tell her about the meat. So he tell her, and then she sleep with him. But the next morning, she say to the dogs, why don't you tell me you can tote meat like a man? Here I've been had to wash your eating trough and tote your grub to you, and you plenty able to bring your plate and fetch your own grub. Then the man, he die, 'cause he told what the dog tell him not to, and the people make a great funeral for 3 days with him. His wife, she cry and cry, 'cause she make him die, but they go to bury him. But the old dog say, no, wait till his father come. He gone away on a journey. So they wait 3 more days. And when the father come, he rubbed medicine on his eyes. And he woke him. And he live a long time after that. And his son get down on the line he brung home. This is Robin Miles. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo by Zora Neale Hurston. Edited and with an introduction by Deborah G. Plant.
Context of white supremacy. That is it. There is no second audio segment. I said this book is very short and we are all done. Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo, context of white supremacy. If you have commentary you would like to share, concluding thought on the text, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Serious business also to make sure, since we are done with this text. We've been talking about the passing of Pamela Evans Harris, guest on the broadcast many, many times over the history of the cows, and she called in many times as well. She authored 4 books. I said Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. We should read that, I think, as the next book. I do not think I would be able to remain composed to read the book for the duration. Certainly not starting next week. It said I'd be willing to read The Interracial Con Game. We can do that. I should be have myself together enough so that I can read that, do the narration for that text. So if anybody would like to contribute, invest, narrator for Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, or narrators. We have done that before. If there are a collection of folks who would be down to begin reading for next Friday, that would be grand. That's it. Again, concluding thoughts on the text. Barracoon, we'll get those in this week. We had a listener write in. This was from the last commentary, which was 2 weeks ago when we had our last segment. We had a listener write in. Question that I asked, why was this book released in 2018? Very important question. We've been thinking about over the time we've been reading this text. Again, this was sat on for basically 60 years. Over 60 years, actually, for a couple of reasons. We talked about those before. Continuing what the person who wrote in had to say, why was this book released? It is to destroy the heroic image of black females by implicating them as the very people who were involved in the slave trade. This is because I saw somewhere in the internet that there is a plan to make a movie about the all-black female soldiers of the Dahomey who played vital roles in defending black people and territories against white supremacist slave raiders, kidnappers, traitors. They fiercely defeated the white supremacist slave raiders in several battle fronts for years. Years after the all-black female soldiers were no more, the white supremacist slave raiders began to meet unmatched fierceness to raid, kidnap, and destroy the weakened black areas. This book instead is projecting negative images of all the black female soldiers as fierce, merciless, and brutal soldiers against their fellow black people, capturing, cutting off their heads, and selling some survivors as slaves. The movie, if it will ever be made at all, will not inspire black people in the way that the Black Panther movie did. I have never watched a Black Panther movie, nor any of the likes. I'm not a movie nor TV person. Never spend my dimes nor minutes of my life in that way. Bravo, bravo, bravo. I have not seen Black Panther either. That is interesting. If such a film is coming out, that is an interesting theory on why this text would be published. If other folks have any ideas as to why this book came out this year, 2018, spring, no less, folks have any thoughts, you can share those. Or if you have any concluding thoughts on the book that finished up today. One question that I asked, the book finished and then there was an appendix with these little anecdotes, little fables, African fables, I guess, that Kasula shared with Miss Hurston. Any idea why those were just kind of included at the end and not really in the fabric of the story? Why would they were there at all, really? I guess you could ask since they were included towards the end of the text. Or that could have been an editing decision 60 years on. Just thoughts on that. Or if you have anything else to share about the text, folks who dialed in with a hand up, lines should be open. Feel free. Folks spectating for the moment. They're hanging out while folks are getting their thoughts together, what have you. I generally try to wait to not give my thoughts or notes. Actually, what I can do, won't have to do either. I can give one of the notes that I found doing a little bit of research and preparing for the program. The godmother, Charlotte Mason, she was not mentioned in the body of the text this week, Charlotte Osgood Mason, but she was mentioned previously several times. And I talked about her. We read the article last week from the LA Review, which gave, I thought, a lot of interesting and important details about this white woman paying Zora Neale Hurston and paying Kasula for their contributions to this work and what her vision was for why she wanted to project this book, this image, to the world. There's a article, My Alma Mater, The University of Virginia, The Problem of White Patronage, Thomas Jefferson's Plantation, Charlotte Osgood Mason and Zora Neale Hurston. I'm not going to read the entire report, but I think just a portion of it relates to the text. The relative obscurity that the work of Zora Neale Hurston suffered for most of her life speaks to the analytical obstructions caused by the perceived influences of white patrons on the work of black artists. One example of this scholarly misunderstanding of Hurston exists in Nathan Huggins' Harlem Renaissance. Huggins devotes 4.5 pages to Hurston, but not one discusses Hurston's literary contributions. The focus is instead on whether or not Hurston's darky act was real or put on. Hurston's relationship with Charlotte Osgood Mason, as well as her tendencies in her own writings to seemingly describe and embody stereotypical and primitive characters, have tended to lead critics like Huggins astray. According to Zora Neale Hurston's autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road, Mrs. Mason, who insisted upon being called Godmother, the group of new Negroes by the group of new Negroes she patronized, was extremely human. Mrs. Mason formerly had been involved with the black community through her donations to Southern black schools. Born Charlotte Vanderveer Quick. Wow. Mason had spent most of her life interested in the folklore of non-white races. Only one race. In the early 1900s, she spent months living amongst the Plains Indians while she patronized Natalie Curtis, the author of a collection of myths and songs entitled The Indian's Book. At the height of the Harlem Renaissance, Mason became interested both financially and personally with the development of new Negro artists such as Hurston, Langston Hughes, and Miguel Covarrubias. According to Langston Hughes, Mason had, in the 20s, discovered the new Negro and wanted to help him, not because she wanted to see the black people excel, but because she saw African Americans as America's greatest link with the primitive. That is a direct quote. In order to get her fill of the primitive, she turned to Alan Locke, who furnished her with the artists capable of supplying evidence of black primitivism in their work. This section, it goes on to talk about Langston Hughes as well. She also worked with him and some of his thoughts about her work. There was one quote that Langston Hughes, I was going to share. Let's see if I can find it really quick. Maybe I will. Oh, wait a minute. Is this it? Yeah, I'll read it later. Anyway, the report goes on to talk about Langston Hughes as well and some of the problems that regularly came up with the artists and Mason's efforts to control Black artists and what they were writing about, that sort of thing. Let's see. Yeah, here we go. Eventually, Herson's involvement with Mrs. Mason proved confining. If her tales failed to express the desired primitive elements in their work when she was denied support, Herson explained, there she was, sitting up there at the table with a cap on, caviar and gleaming silver, eager to hear every word on every phase of life on a sawmill job. That's a direct quote from Herston about the godmother. I must tell the tales, sing the songs, do the dances, and repeat the raucous sayings and doings of the Negro furthest down, direct quote. Langston Hughes, too, severed his relationship with Mason because, as he similarly recounts, she wanted me to be primitive and feel the intuitions of the primitive, but unfortunately I did not feel the rhythms of the primitive surging through me, and so I could not live and write as though I did. I was only an American Negro who had loved the surface of Africa and the rhythms of Africa, but I was not Africa. And I will stop there. Just, I think that's really important for me. Knowing that information made it very difficult to process the narrative, the stories, any of it really, to process this as, oh, wow, this is the authentic word of Kasula and Zora Neale Hurston putting this together. It seemed more like, or in my view, it's more keeping in mind, this is the creation. This is what a suspected racist, the image that she wanted to project to the world. And remembering the report that I read last week, where Zora Neale Hurston, this was not a book that she bragged about, and, you know, going through life, apparently, with great sorrow and pity, and telling other people that she was so disappointed that whites wouldn't publish this book, and that was not the case. It didn't seem like this was a work that she was really proud about publishing, apparently. If people have information to the contrary, let's hear it. Let's get that on the record. But I just did not feel that way. I expressed some of the things, elements that I thought were peculiar when we talked about this book last week, to have a Black male, or female for that matter, in Alabama in the 1920s, early 20th century. And a lot of what you're talking about is your frustrations with other Black people. Black people are frustrating to me and others now, 2018. But I mean, wow, we're talking Alabama years, decades before the Montgomery bus boycott, almost a century before the lynching museum that Big Victim visited. I mean, all the atrocities. I think in the 1920s, this would have been before the Scottsboro Boys case, unless my memory is in error. I'll check on that. But I mean, way early era in white terrorism. And most of your frustrations, or many of your frustrations, are focused on conflicts and disliking by other Black people who happen to be born in this part of the world. That is peculiar at minimum. Anywho, I'll check again to see if other folks have commentary. Again, final portion of the text. We are all done. There is no second audio segment. Next week, we will be moving on. Hopefully, we'll have a narrator or narrators for Black Love is a Revolutionary Act for next Friday. But this here, our last session on Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon. Folks with a hand up, I guess it took them a little time to get it together. If you have any final thoughts you would like to get in on the text, proceed.
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, greetings. Was that someone else trying to get in at the same time?
That was another line, but they didn't say anything. It sounded like they were just a little background noise as they probably prepare to get themselves together. So proceed.
Oh, okay. Yes. Well, I wanted to chime in because I'm happy that you read what you read and gave us a little more insight on, you know, the purpose of this book. You know, it has, you know, she had a racist intent you know, in financing this whole project. And then that puts all the pieces of the puzzle together, you know, why Zora Neale Hurston would end up, you know, penniless in the end and not being recognized for work and all of that because of the racist interference. And because, like you said, of the purse strings of Miss Charlotte Mason, you know, she just kind of, that one person, you know, trying to preserve her ideology about other people being primitive, the Native Americans and then later on blacks or whoever else she thought. That is just a racist ideology that she was trying to make a legacy on. So she would go up there with one of the, you know, I think one of the highest or most notorious racists, you know. But anyway, back to Cazula. I felt that that last part where it was, I guess, folklore or parable or whatever about the lion and the dogs bringing the meat. You know, I read that several times. I listened to it over and over again. I tried to make some sense out of that using, you know, different methods. And really, I can't get anything. And from what I know about African culture, from listening to speakers from the continent, all different countries, you know, and giving those parables and what I've read, I've never encountered anything like that. So it seems to me that unless I'm really missing it, the parables that, you know, and the Africans would give would have, you know, an understanding, something you could understand. You could use some type of formula to find out a lesson in that. And I failed to get that from the last part of the book. And then now that we know exactly what happened, you know, then it's no doubt that, you know, that's exactly what was going on with this literary work. And it probably was a good idea, you know, not to be published for 60 years. Because if you think about it, not only did Cazula, he was the last one, but think of the other millions of others who had lives and, you know, the same encounters, what they encountered. You know, that's just as important as his. And if you don't have an accurate rendition of it, you're still at a loss. So I'll mute my line, and I want to say this for last. I thought I heard you mention Pam, Trojan Pam, and that we may be doing a book, but did you say that she had encountered something?
She passed away earlier this year, unfortunately.
Oh, man, that makes me sad.
Lots of us. We did a program on Wednesday in tribute to her, where many folks called in with their commentary and appreciation for her life and work. But yeah, I found or a listener mailed me her obituary a few days back, which was the first that I heard of it. I shared it with listeners on social media a few days back, and we did the program in her honor on Wednesday evening. Should be in the archives, but I think a lot of people just found out recently, unfortunately. Very sad news, her passing. She had been having some health issues that I knew about. The listener found out he had been trying to buy her books and was having difficulty getting in touch with her. I had been emailing and calling, and also had been having difficulty getting in touch with her, which was peculiar in the time that I knew her. And then we found out what had happened. But yes, that's why we should be reading Black Love is a Revolutionary Act in her honor starting next week, if we have folks who would be down to narrate.
Okay. thank you, Gus, and I'll mute my line, and I'll put in a vote for that book, too. I already have it. I'll be ready. Thank you, Gus.
For sure, Mr. Demery. For other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and the rest of the callers, listeners on the line. It's Rob in San Diego. So I chimed in late, but like Demery Four, I was very confused with the parable or the story that she was telling about the animals. I was wanted to ask if anyone had clarification for that part of the text. And I guess this is a very short text. I wanted to ask how many audio sessions was this text as well? And that's all I had.
Three. This is our third and final session, and there's only one audio segment. We normally do two audio segments per session, but this is a very short book. And I guess if you really want to have it in context, the first audio session that we did, half of that, like a full hour of the audio that we listened to, was just the introduction. And a solid chunk of that was not even written by Zora Neale Hurston herself. That was Deborah G. Plant and Alice Walker with the foreword. Oh, we didn't even hear the foreword, but we talked about it a little bit. So that's the first chunk. And then at the end, you have the appendix with these fables that, you know, I don't know. These could have just been asides. Anyway, it's very, very, very short text. Very, very short text. And if anybody has clarification on the folk tales that we heard at the end, that would be great. I cannot offer a whole lot. That those stories did not resonate with me. I was not able to get any sort of great insight. And as I said, for me, Charlotte Mason, that really distorts, because I was thinking, you know, if I'm a black person in this era, really any era, and a white person is paying me because they want to hear some primitive Negro tales, I might just make up anything. It's just like, whatever. Make up any kind of wild story that you can think of. Yes, the camel and the monkey were feuding. Yeah, that sounds good. That's a clank. I could see that happening. These could be totally legit. I'm not making light of it. I'm just saying for me, they did not resonate. I did not understand. And the dominant factor in all of that is not that I don't believe Kasula. It's that there's someone that I suspect that is a racist that is funding not even just one person, but they're paying the person who wrote it and the person who's doing the talking. That is, you know, at least calls for me to be extraordinarily suspicious. Other folks who have a hand up, if you have a comment, or if we certainly have anybody who has an understanding or appreciation for the folk tales that we heard, you should for sure not be a spectator today. You should, you know, get a hand up and share. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed. Let's see. Did you have commentary, Ivy, or are you just listening?
Thanks, Gus. I'm not able to talk right this moment, but, I'll chime back in when I can. But thank you.
Much obliged. Much obliged. If other folks have any final thoughts, you can feel free to share as well. The anecdotes and what have you at the end. Even some of the earlier ones that were not the animals, like the one where it was the men were fighting and they didn't snitch. They didn't snitch on each other. And the king, I guess, rewarded them. He gave them, it was like 10 of everything and sent them on their way. And then they divided the cow evenly. Did that one resonate with anybody? I did not have as much of a problem with, I guess solidarity at some level. I don't know. Did that one resonate with anyone? They're fighting over the cow. They all wanted a hind leg. Three males cannot have a hind leg. Or were there only two?
The part about three people not being able to get the two hind legs resonated with me, especially being where I am now, where people are almost living on top of each other and constantly fighting for resources.
I understood. Yeah, that one, not a problem. Not a problem, I thought. I'm trying to think if...
You know, also I could say that I understood that one. And it is, say similar to, say, the two women in the Bible or whatever, arguing about whose child it was. And then the wise man or the king say, you cut them in half and get one half and another half. And whichever one said, no, let her have it. That would be the mother of the child. You know, something like that. You can get something out of it. But the last reading, you know, I looked at it. I read it over and over. I can't get anything from it. So if anybody does have it, I appreciate knowing myself. Thanks, sir.
Myself as well. If anybody really enjoyed these parables, if you really enjoyed them, or if you really, or even if you didn't understand them, you just enjoyed them, you think they are authentic, that would be grand. Would love hearing that perspective. Let's see. The person that dialed in, retired firefighter, if you have commentary, you should be with us, sir.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. First, I would just like to say that I didn't have the time to listen through most of the three sessions because of situation involving my mother. But I kind of like overlooked some of the information about the person known as Barracoon. He had another name that was associated with him that I'm familiar with because I went to a attended college in a in Oklahoma, and it was a family that last name was Cudjoe, and that name is also associated in Jamaica as people who were runaways. Was that described in the book at any time?
No, sir. That was the name, the main character, Kasula. I don't know what you would call it. When he arrived in this part of the world, he explains in the narrative that the new name that he got was Cudjoe right. Lewis. That was a new name that he got, but his original African name was Kasula. Barracoon was the name of the slave pens that they were held in on the West Coast. That wasn't the name. That wasn't his African name. His African name was Kasula. But no.
Okay.
They didn't explain or give any origins for the name Cudjoe. They just explained that that was the name that he took. I think the name that he took himself when he got here, that was the new name. And then the rest of the book, I think for the most part, they use Kasula to describe or to reference him by.
Yes, it's pretty much a historical name because of the Maroons in the area of the earth that's called Jamaica, who quote-unquote escaped from that form of white supremacy, at least from the field anyway. And what, as I mentioned it when I was in college, I kept hearing this student whose name was Lance Cudjoe, and I always thought that was a strange name. I didn't know anything about it until watching a documentary on indigenous peoples in this part of the world. Of course, just like everybody else that's non-white, they were mistreated and deceived by white supremacists with some sort of treaty where they were supposed to be given something, and it was, quote unquote, was not carried out. And the family still had the receipt and or documents. And they flashed the next part of the episode of the documentary. They flashed to the actual people. And I saw who was the basketball coach at Langston University during the time when I was there. And his last name, he was the student I mentioned, he was his father, the head basketball coach. And his last name was Cudjoe. So, you know, I'm kind of like seeing that, I saw that name, but I saw the name and the actual person that the book is talking about. You can actually see it on YouTube. The actual person that the book is talking about, and they also made up and put in front of a church that he started a bust in Mobile, Alabama, kind of like recently. I don't know if that was talked about at all on the program, but just some observations that I had, you know, just to be able to have something to say, being that I didn't participate in the book reading. And that's it. Thank you.
Right on. Retired firefighter. Well, it is all done now, so we'll all be starting with a fresh slate, as they say, next Friday. Brand new text. We'll all be starting from page one. If other folks have commentary, particularly if you have any commentary about the fables and such at the end of the text. And I just want to make sure I do get on the record. Everything in this book can be totally true. Let's say for a moment it is. The reason that I have suspicion, or anybody else, in my view, that is totally logical, the system of white supremacy, primary weapon, deception. We've talked a lot, especially in the book club, about ghostwriters and how many times, how many books we've read where whites have had a hand in the writing and what type of influence that has on the final product. That's the case with Richard Williams' book, Serena Williams' dad, Venus Williams' dad. That's the case with Madiba's autobiography. Tons of the texts that we've read on this program. The system of white supremacy, where you have a white woman funding this text that warrants, is logical to be suspicious at minimum, especially given the objective that she states bluntly about wanting to show this primitive side to the world. So everything in this text could be totally true. Receiving that, appreciating that, learning from that is obstructed by the system of racism, white supremacy. That's why it needs to be done away with as soon as possible. The person who dialed in, 0639, did you have commentary?
May I be heard?
Absolutely.
How are you this evening, Gus?
Right poorly.
Right poorly. Wow. Okay, I won't ask you what that means. Unfortunately, I got in late, and so I didn't hear the last section. As a new participant, I'm trying to figure out how this system works and what your time and everything is. But the previous caller mentioned the word or the name Cudjoe. And I would like, as soon as I heard him say that, it I knew it was similar, and so I looked up examples of Ghanaian day names. They named by the day of the week, and it's spelled K-U-J-O-E, Cujo. How's it spelled in the book?
C-U-D-J-O. Okay. And again, that's the name that he picked stateside. The name that he uses for the bulk of the book is Kasula.
Right. I just thought that was odd that there would be a Ghanaian name, Cujo. Could be pronounced, even though it's spelled different, it's pronounced the same. I don't know if that has any meaning or significance. It's just something that, you know, raised my awareness when I heard the previous caller talk about. Thank you.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, thoughts. Apparently, we didn't get anyone who was just, or at least we didn't get any live listeners who were just thrilled about the fables at the end of the book, or maybe they're being shy. It would be grand to hear from those folks if they are present. But if any other folks have commentary questions they want to get in, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Man, Gus, you, well, first of all, greetings to you. Greetings to all the callers on the line. You threw me a layup and made me feel better about my, I guess, take on this book. My take on it is that, I mean, I have a lot of scattered thoughts, but my take on it is that I don't trust it at all. When you think about all the things that you pointed out and that you read tonight as well as last week about how, you know, a race soldier financed his book. She paid the author. She paid Kasula. And the fact also that it was released after she passed away. And immediately this book, in my view, was suspect to me. Just even getting, I believe, I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong, because I think you just pointed this out a moment ago as well, that it was a black woman who did, I don't know, the introduction or the foreword, whichever one, that was talking about the plagiarism. So it's like you got this black person talking about, you know, this alleged plagiarism, which, you know, she's not here to defend herself, so I don't believe that. I just kind of take that with a grain of salt. It could or could not be true. I'm not going to just believe it because a victim said it, because a victim could be deceived and misled into saying something like that. And, you know, thinking about also the things that you pointed out about how, you know, there's all this complaining about black people, but all this defending of white people, that is just, I mean, that right there just really cuts at the credibility of the book and sounds like something that serves white interests. And, you know, they do a lot of lying about slavery. And I'll say this again, I do not believe that. I believe that it's a bunch of lies in terms of black people selling other black people to white people. And it's a new lie because I remember when that lie was not being told. I remember when white people taught that white people invaded Africa at gunpoint with chains and shackles and kidnapped everybody that they enslaved. And now they're telling a new lie. And the newer lies is that black people weren't enslaved at all, that we were immigrant workers and that we were happy and well-fed. There are books on this, and these are in Texas textbooks, as well as a book somewhere else. That might be Texas, too. I can't remember where it was because some race soldier was talking about that as well. But I'm just really referring to the black woman who talked about this, and she showed it on a video on a Facebook about where it was talking about we were immigrant workers and this, that, and the other. So they just, you know, they tell a lot of lies, so I don't really have no, I just really don't trust this book at all. And I'm glad for the extra background information that you read last week and some things that you read this week to just bring even more clarity to all this. So I'm grateful to you for what you shared. And
yeah, I think at least for now, that's all I had. That's all I could think of in terms of my notes, and I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. I would be interested in hearing, because there were a number of Cal's listeners who requested that we read this book. Again, it was just published a few months ago, and it got a lot of attention in major press outlets. So listeners saw it, they wanted to read it, they were intrigued by the write-ups and what have you. I'd be interested in what they think, like based on, you know, what they saw, if they read something or heard an interview or however they found out about this book, what they thought it was going to be. And then, you know, if you read it or if you listened in with us, now what? Now that you've read it, now that we got to the conclusion, you know, what do you think? Did it meet your expectations or what have you? I'd be very curious. I can speak for myself, the little bit that I knew about the text going into it. I mean, I guess to Ivy's point, the immediate focus, because we, as I said, we spent, I think, an hour before we even got into the text. We didn't even get to chapter one of the book because of the introductions in the text, plural, and the foreword, which wasn't even a part of the audiobook by Alice Walker. There's so much packing at the beginning, and so much of that is focused on Black people selling other Black people. That was something I was not anticipating. I was not, you know, thinking, yes, that's what this book is going to be focused on. The story of the last Black person to survive the Middle Passage. And we're going to be reading about Black people selling other Black people. Like, that just seems very incongruent if whites are most to blame for what they call the Middle Passage triangle trade. But hearing so much of that at the very beginning of the text, and particularly, it was in Alice Walker's Alice Walker Cowbell, same Alice Walker who brought us The Color Purple, marvel of Black male and Black female harmony. Alice Walker's foreword, where she says, and it's in all capital letters, and I think it's in italics, Africans weren't just victims of slavery. I'll go because I highlighted it. But that's in the foreword of the text. I was not expecting that when I read about the book and, you know, was hearing about, oh, this is what this is about. Okay, that's great. We should do it for the book club. That brought a lot of suspicion for me, and especially because in the text it's presented as, for most Black people, this is news. For most Black people, they don't accept this. And I just don't think that that's accurate, 2018. I just heard randomly Black people presenting that very argument to minimize white supremacy, that we can't just sit around and talk about white people because other Black people were selling. I just heard, like, in between us doing segment number two of this book and the session that we're doing today, just ran. And I hear it all the time, like on the program, you know, just going about my business between yoga classes and what have you. I hear it on a regular basis. I think that that's false, that Black people don't know about or don't accept this or don't, you know, factor that into the equation when thinking about racism or us being slaves, the earlier aspect of slavery in racism. Maybe that's just me. Any other folks have final thoughts, questions, comments that they want to get in on Barracoon? Yes, ma'am.
I just want to make a quick comment since someone else was speaking up. Man, oh my goodness, that is so true what you just said, Gus. Like, it is a very rare occasion that you will find a victim who does not believe, who challenges this, what I call, new lie about Black people selling other Black people. They will assert this, and they don't have no proof or no evidence or no nothing or no logic or anything else, in my view, because there's a whole lot of holes in that lie, a lot of contradictions. But you hear many of us, I would even say most people who speak on it, come back with that statement. A lot of us believe that and say that. So that is not true. And one more quick thing, another new lie, which you, I want to say you talk about all the time, but forgive me if I'm wrong about that, about that Sally Hemings was not raped, that, you know, he had a relationship with a 14-year-old child. And my thing is,
the race soldiers, the white people who say that and who propagate that lie and who tell that lie, I don't even think they realize that they are child rapists themselves to even suggest that a 14-year-old child can have a relationship with an adult. Or worse, they do realize that they're child rapists for saying that, and they just don't care. I'll mute my line.
Indeed, I have written about that a few times, as did Pam the Great, a software developer in Wisconsin. Did you have commentary? You should be with us as well.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm in a store, so I'm trying to exit here. I had a question to pose to the listeners who actually have the text. What do you think the significance was of the plagiarism portion that was actually in the, I guess, the afterwards of the book, in the published book, actually being included in the introduction in the audiobook? I don't know if you addressed that or not, because that information was provided in the actual published text, but it was not at the beginning of the book. That's the question I have.
Okay, making sure I understand it. The information about Zora Neale Hurston allegedly plagiarizing work related to Kasula in previous work that she did on him before this text, that was included at the beginning of the audiobook, that it's at the end, it's at the afterword of the actual hard copy text.
Correct.
Okay. What do people think about that difference? I would think more people, I could be in error, I would think more people who access the text now are going to access it via reading it than listening to the audiobook. I think even in 2018, I think more people tend to read a book than listen to the audiobook. I could be in error. You all can let me know if my thinking is off on that. But I think, yeah, more people would tend to read it than the audiobook. So I think most people, if they read it, if they're reading the book, they would get to that last. I don't know. I knew that information before we started the audiobook, so it was not new to me. And that didn't, I can't say that was a heavy factor in terms of how I thought about the book or processing that information. That wasn't a big deal for me. That had way less significance than the godmother, I'll put it that way. Any other people have any thoughts on the difference in position, the information about the alleged plagiarism?
Yes, may I be heard?
Mr. Demery Four?
Yes. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I really want to start off with, you know, a definition of plagiarism. But is that just a lack of adding a footnote? You know, because you could use information that someone else has written or some research that they come up with, as long as you give them credit, you know, in a footnote or whatever, some type of recognition. So we already know that that's one of the racist tactics, is to create a situation and then put all the blame back on the black person who had no power in editing, maybe writing, but then what got edited and later on published may not have been exactly what they said. And so I would just, you know, ask that question first. You know, what did they mean when they say plagiarism?
My memory might be in error, but I think at minimum there was no footnote, no reference or citation for the source that she is alleged she allegedly copied material from, and it may have been. This is the part that I just don't recall. I'd have to look back to see if they like give exact details, but it may have been like wholesale copying of material without, you know, quotations as well. That part I'm just not sure about, but I know definitely it was no citation. That was a part of the allegation.
Right. And I think that, you know, accusing a writer of that would just be in line with discrediting and making sure that they did not get recognized, you know, exactly what ended up happening in her life, just a victim, you know. So including it at the beginning or wherever, once they get that out there, you know, it's almost like, you know, your credibility is shot. So they can discredit everything that you write, but that doesn't mean that it's not worth, you know, investigating other books or other material that she has written. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For I think for the record, the person who first made this allegation that Zora Neale Hurston plagiarized some of her work, not this book, but previous work about Casula, was a white man, suspected racist. He also is a Hurston biographer, and he put this information together. And I think he said that, you know, this should not detract from her work, her legacy. She's done, you know, tons of standout work. He gave, you know, his own explanation as to what could have happened, but he wrote a book about her. Like, he, you know, was trying to show people, talk about her legacy. It certainly could have been an act of racism, white supremacy, but I could certainly see, you could look at the evidence and say, well, he was presenting, this is a part of what he presented in trying to show people her work. Cause he did write a biography about her, which was, you know, drawing attention to her life, works and what have you. And, you know, he didn't present this as a, you know, she was no good stealing, thieving, such and such, that sort of thing. Like, you know, this was way early in her career. This was before, like, Their Eyes Were Watching God and all this. Like, this was way, way long time ago. That's why for me, like, this is like super, super insignificant. Like, whatever, if she did, whatever, moving forward with things. Because I knew about this before the book. This was not my first time hearing this information.
I'm sorry. I just want to clarify. I'm not necessarily affected by the plagiarism. However, by the accusation of plagiarism, I should say. And I don't necessarily know that I entirely believe these accusations, but I do think that those accusations would, I guess, influence or inform the way somebody reads this book. And I wonder just why those accusations of plagiarism were included in this text when they weren't necessarily needed, and then why they were included in the audiobook. I mean, even if they were included in the text in the afterword, that was fine, but included in the audiobook at the beginning, prior to even getting to the actual text, I think that would inform some listeners of the audiobook, inform the way they perceive the information. So that's why I just asked that question.
That is a good point. The afterword is not in the audiobook. The audiobook, even though it's unabridged, the actual like text, what Zora Neale Hurston wrote, all of that is included, but all of the extras that they include with the hard copy of the text is not in the audiobook. Like Alice Walker's foreword is not in the audiobook either. So yeah, you don't get the exact duplicate from the audiobook. That might be why they include that information about the alleged plagiarism at the beginning of the audiobook, since the afterword is not included in the audiobook, maybe. Any other thoughts on the, I guess, the placement of the alleged plagiarism, or if people even think that would impact how folks are hearing or reading the book.
May I be here?
Yes, ma'am.
I want to say that I agree with that. I think everybody pointed out that the point of that, wherever it's placed, is to impact people's mindset, for lack of words, when they read that book and anything else. Because if I'm not mistaken, she is a renowned author for, you know, Her Eyes Are Watching God and some other stuff. And I think that it doesn't make any sense to me. Now, maybe that's just my lack of intellect, but it doesn't make any sense to me, unless it's malicious, for you to even include in any book, other than maybe her autobiography, that she plagiarized anything. What is the point of that? Like, that to me does not make any sense, except for like just a hit piece, and not on, I think, again, a victim is supposedly said this, not originally, but in this part or something like that, or if that's true. But either way, in my view, racists are behind it, whether indirectly or directly. And I think that that was the whole point of it, because it just doesn't make no sense for it to be there in any place in the whole book. So, yeah, I just think that that was to begin or end a book like that is to damage her credibility with, first of all, the book that is being talked about, and second of all, any other things that she does. And one more quick thing is that people who understand something about racism are going to dismiss claims like that, whether it be by a victim or whoever. And by dismiss, I mean not hold it against her, whether it's true or not. But your average person is not going to do that, especially when it comes to a black person. Anything negative that is said about a black person in this world, on this planet, dominated by racism and white supremacy, is very, very powerful. And we already have negative mentalities toward each other and toward just black people, period. Everybody already has that. So when you add that, it just makes it more powerful. And I think it is going to be, you know, very impactful in people's mind. They're going to keep it in the back of their minds. And I think even those who know something about racism, they would struggle with that as well. But they might be able to better handle it than maybe the average person.
Well said. Well said, Ivy.
Appreciate that. One theory I have as to why the plagiarism accusation is being included, I am not a scholar on Barack Hoon or Zora Neale Hurston. However, when you begin reading or doing research on this book, the plagiarism accusations come up pretty quickly. Because they'll give background that this isn't the first time that she wrote about this subject, and then they'll go to the earlier piece and blah, blah, blah. Like, that just generally seems to be the way that they go. It might be a case of if you read this book and do any research, and then you find information about these accusations, which you assuredly will, it will seem like, oh man, they tried to avoid it or what have you. It could be a situation of, let's just go ahead and address this. I think it's insignificant. The person who made these accusations said the same. Let's just go ahead and address it, get it out in the open, and then move forward. That might have been the theory. It could have been an act of racism, white supremacy.
Oh, it's definitely an act of racism, white supremacy. just a placement. That's all. Sorry.
While I was looking for, I just want to give the white man's name who made this accusation or presented this charge in his biography on Hurston. While I was looking for all of that, this is what I came across. Talking about her time as a journalist, this is in the 1940s. Wow, I'm hoping I can get my hands on this. During her last decade, Hurston. During her last decade, Hurston worked as a freelance writer, Gus T, for magazines and newspapers. In the fall of 1952, she was contacted by Sam Nunn, editor of the Pittsburgh Courier, to go to Florida to cover the murder trial of Ruby McCollum. McCollum was charged with murdering a white doctor and politician who McCollum said had forced her to have sex and bear his child. Interracial con game. Hurston recalled what she had seen of white male sexual dominance in the lumber camps in North Florida and discussed it with Nunn. They both thought the case might be about such paramour rights and wanted to expose it to a national audience. Upon reaching Live Oak, Hurston was surprised not only by the gag order the judge in the trial placed on the defense, but by her inability to get residents in town to talk about the case. Both blacks and whites were silent. She believed that might have been related to Dr. Adams' alleged involvement as well in Sam McCollum's gambling operation. Her articles were published by the newspaper during the trial. Ruby McCollum was convicted by an all-white, all-male jury and sentenced to death. Hurston had a special assignment to write a serialized account, the life story of Ruby McCollum, over 3 months in 1953 in the newspaper. Her part was ended abruptly when she and Nunn disagreed about her pay and she left. Oh, wait a minute, there's more. Unable to pay independently to return for the appeal and second trial, she contacted journalist William Bradford Hugh, with whom she had worked at the American Mercury, to try to interest him in the case. He covered the appeal and second trial and also developed material from a background investigation. Hurston shared her material with him from the first trial, but he acknowledged her only briefly in his book. Now, that is an act of racism, and this is a white guy. Ruby McCollum, Woman in the Sewanee Jail, which became a bestseller. Hurston celebrated that McCollum's testimony in her own defense marked the first time that a woman of African-American descent was allowed to testify as to the paternity of her child by a white man. My God, we need to read this. Hurston firmly believed that Ruby McCollum's testimony sounded the death toll of paramour rights and the segregationist South. Wow. Incredible. Zora Neale Hurston, black journalist. I will make an effort to see if we can get some of the writing that she did on this, the reports, and then the book. One, I guess we'll find out if William Bradford Huey, if this is a white person, non-white person. I'm not sure. I'm not able to see a picture. I'll share once I find a photograph. But that is amazing. The interracial con game. Wowie. Any other thoughts folks had to share about the placement? I got a little off track there. That's what I was looking for, was information about the plagiarism and all, and that's what I found. Any other commentary on the plagiarism? Looks like go ahead. Just sorry. William Bradford Huey looks like is a white person. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say yes. I do agree with that assessment. But I think that the way you would look at it would be slightly different if you heard it prior than if you heard it afterwards. But I do agree that the accusations of plagiarism, regardless, are very damaging and probably will impact the way people view all of her work, including Their Eyes Are Watching God. Thank you.
Much obliged, codified software developer. Other folks have any comments, thoughts they want to get in?
Matt Beard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to quickly say thank you guys for your kind words. In that, as far as the plagiarism, one last thing. When I first heard it on the audio, I remember thinking immediately, oh, man, what is this doing here? Like, here we go. And that, thinking about what you said, Gus, about how people are more likely to read, I think that's true. But I think you get a book and you read it, it's more difficult when you're reading it live or directly for your mind to wander. But when you're listening an audio book or something like that, something audio, it's kind of easier for your mind to wander. So I'm thinking that maybe they put that in there in the beginning so that before your mind starts wondering, I want you to remember this, and I want you to get this, and I want you to hear that. And I think that's why they put it at the beginning. Whereas with the book, a lot of times when you sit down to read it and you bought it and all of that, you're probably invested where you are going to read it to the end and you are going to read all of it. So I just think that was just another way to make sure that we heard that the people who listen to it heard it, and the people who actually read it, they're going to get it as well, because they're probably going to read it to the end. Whereas, you know, you have kind of a more of a chance, I think, to miss it with an audio book versus if you just sit down and read it. So that's, I guess, I'm in my life.
Indeed. I am going to try to see if we can get both the articles and this book on Ruby McCollum. This looks like one of those that's difficult to find. Like, the copies that I've seen so far on Amazon are like for $200 and something ridiculous. So it must be the same sort of thing that they do with Dr. Welsing's books and Mr. Fuller's books from time to time. So I'm going to see if I can track down a copy, and maybe we can do that for the book club. And definitely I'm going to see if I can find some of the articles that Miss Hurston wrote on the trial, because that just seems interracial con game. just keep adding. Let's see. Yeah, I'll post some links once I can find them. That's amazing. That's why, just doing a little research, that's one of the ways that you can learn a lot about racism, white supremacy. I think I've heard Mr. Fuller say that most of the black people that, you know, we regard, look up to, think well of, most of them, it's for what they did about racism, white supremacy. That's generally, I mean, Coretta Scott King, Rosa Parks, Dr. King, Assata Shakur, Winnie Mandela, on and on and on. Most of the people that we have some regard for, it's because of what they did about racism, white supremacy. Just learning about their lives, you can learn quite a bit about the system, what it is, how it works. Let's see. So if people have access to the Pittsburgh Courier, black newspaper, Importance of Black Journalists, it's January to March 1953. And it's a series of articles, actually from October 1952 to 1953, and then the life story of Ruby McCollum, January to March 1953. But a series in the Pittsburgh Courier, if you have access, if you have like a major university college library in your area, or a really good public library, folks that are in D.C., Library of Congress, you can probably go and see if they have that material. That would make a great field trip. If you have teens, oh, fantastic. You could go read all about the Me Too movement, right? If you have any teens and they have any work assignments where they have to do a written project on the Me Too movement, bang, Black history, Me Too, right there, decades before, same exact problem, and a trial, no less. Phenomenal. I'll see if I can track that down. They'll probably have that at the University of Washington Library. Any other folks have commentary that they need to get in? Everyone satisfied? Caller, last four digits, 5771. 5771, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I wanted to comment about the plagiarism and what Mr. Demery Ford had said about just being a fact of, you know, just missing footnotes. And it goes back to an experience I had in college in a class where I wrote a paper. And what happened was I forgot to footnote some information of a text that we were using in that particular class. And when that happened, I was reported to the dean in regards to plagiarizing my paper. Now, everything was footnoted with the exception of those footnotes. Now, I was still, you know, trying to learn how to write papers and everything, but I was reported for plagiarism. However, I had a racist professor too. So, however, the whites let me off and was able to accept that it was basically out of ignorance that I did that. But they sent me to a writing class that I had to do for 2 weeks in order to do that. But, you know, obviously it's practicing racism in university because of the fact that, you know, I was still learning how to write research papers. And I was assuming that, you know, the textbook that we were using were, you know, was just, you know, given knowledge. But apparently there was this big brouhaha about, you know, me plagiarizing a paper, which I actually didn't. But, you know, and I, you know, when Mr. Demery Ford said that, I thought about that situation. But I also wanted to tackle some of the stuff in the appendix. It was confusing with I think it's called the Tachio game. It was supposed to be a memory game because I guess this is sort of like symbolic of Casulo's, you know, memory. But then when you go on to the next part about, you know, stories told by stories Casulo told me, he starts to say that he forgot about all that. And I remember early in the book, he was talking about how he remembered stuff. So I was very confused about that, you know, and, you know, it kind of makes me think, you know, about the editing in this book. It, you know, it's been talked about all night in regards to the editing in this book and, you know, the contradictions that's going on in this book. The one that stood out to me, in as far as the appendix, was the monkey and the camel. Now, I kind of look at that symbolically in regards to non-white black people in relations to white people. You got the monkey who's basically, you know, doing all the work for the camel, giving, you know, him, you know, the melons and everything. And then when he gets tired, the camel is accusing the monkey of being, you know, no good lazy nigra, and, you know, trying to, you know, put him on trial, you know, just for, you know, because he's not giving, you know, all the melons that the camel wants. So I look at that as, you know, non-white black people's relation to white people and white supremacy working, you know, in that way where, you know, and I'm assuming that Casulo is talking about slavery because, you know, obviously after slavery, you know, non-white black people were considered lazy, you know, since we were, you know, so-called released from, slavery. I, too, was kind of confused on that last story of the lion and the woman. The only thing I can think of in regards to that, you know, because there's a lot of symbolism in that story in regards to the lion. I guess the lion is a symbol of, you know, justice and, you know, the lion is trying to get justice for her children because they were killed by the man's boy, and the dogs being a symbol of loyalty. And I guess at the end, the man broke the loyalty of the dogs and he ended up dying. But I can't put it together. I was just trying to piece the symbolism together with the animals. And also, too, in between, you know, you had the biblical stories of Jonah and the whale and Abraham. So I guess that's a, you know, that's just a mark of his, you know, of his Christianity that he wanted to display. So that's all for now. I'll mute my line.
Grand. The University of Washington. I've talked about the grand resources in the great city of Seattle. The University of Washington at Seattle, doesn't matter, as long as you're in the UW system, they do have access, online access to the Pittsburgh Courier. So I am going to make a little field trip down the block and go on campus and get the articles that Ms. Hurston wrote for the Courier and see if I can get PDFs of what she wrote about the McCollum trial. In fact, I can even look to see if they have that book specifically, the book that Robert McCollum wrote. I'll see if they have, or not Robert McCollum, written on Ruby McCollum, written by William Huey. I'll see if they have that at the library as well. That would be grand, and maybe we can get that in the book club down the road. Any other comments folks want to get in? Questions, comments?
Here?
Yes, ma'am.
Since no one spoke up, I wanted to ask, can I ask a question about racism in general?
I prefer if the book club, we can stay on topic. Just people have a tendency over the years to float off onto all kinds of things. We started off talking about the book club, and somehow now we're talking about Get Out and circus animals and woof. Like, yeah, if you can wait 24 hours to the compensatory call in, that would be super, super great.
Okay, I'll just say this real quick then. When you made the joke about something about you could just say anything because, you know, the white people hate for it about the monkey thing, man, I'll see you in court, Gus. I know you're not supposed to sue black people, but I'll see you in court because my side started hurting so bad just laughing when you said that. That was it. I'm in my line.
For sure. Being truthful. And I think I've heard that from other black people before. They just, Thomas in New York said he does that. Just make up stuff when, you know, white people are coming around hankering for good darky stories. Make up a good one. Anything else, folks? Gotta get in. Question, comment. Last time commenting on Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo. I will assume folks are good. Looks like swing and a miss. They do not have Mr. Huey's book at the library. I will have to keep digging. This is an older publication, so might be a little bit more challenging to find, but I will continue searching. In the meantime, once I am able to get those articles that Zora Neale Hurston wrote, I will share. Oh my goodness, I'm so excited about that. That's the sort of thing that I think Pam would have been really excited about as well, just to get that long history, especially if I heard or if I read that correctly, that this is a black female who killed a white man around sexual terrorism and abuse. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I would love lots of information. And just, I think that is so critically important, Zora Neale Hurston taking her time and energy to cover this trial and recognizing the importance of getting this out, the sexual terrorism that had gone on for so long. But also this notion that black people don't fight back. I thought about that yesterday with Omar Thornton. If for nothing else, he should be brought up every August for that reason alone. If for no other reason, it seems like there's a lot to learn, but if for no other reason, that nonsense that black people are cowards. Black people never fought back ever since the continent. We just worked, cooperated with whites, exactly what we heard in the text. That's exactly what we've done forever. And that's why we continue to suffer from racism. I hear that all the time as well. I don't hear that quite as often as black people sold other black people, but I hear it pretty regularly. It is extremely important to be able to stop that every single time. Whoa. You are very ill-informed. You can, however which way you want it, if you want ancient history, whatever you consider ancient to be, if you need some older versions of black people fighting back, many of those, if you need more current, how current do you need it to be? Omar Thornton current? Ruby McCollum current? Lots of different versions. We've talked about this repeatedly. That was one of the reasons that I really appreciated Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, because he has lots of footnoted anecdotes of rebellions, uprisings, black people killing white slave masters in order to end the torture and terrorism. But lots of illustrations. We have not been cowards. We have shown a lot of courage in the face of flagrant terrorism. Are folks satisfied? Anything else folks need to get in?
Just wanted to ask the question, because I think the central figure in this book is an interesting subject. I was wondering if there's any information on a more scientific interview or analysis of someone who was a participant, unwillingly, of course, in the Atlantic voyages, terroristic voyages. Is there anyone who have did any notations or books or a book on, in a more scientific way, on such anybody who was in the Atlantic slave trade as a slave?
What do you mean when you say more scientific?
Where they're actually interviewing the person, and that person is basically narrating their experiences.
That's not what happened here.
Okay, well, like I said, I wasn't involved with the reading. I wasn't. Okay, that's basically what's taking place with this book. Huh? That basically what it was with this book was the person actually stating their experiences. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. yeah, it's in the archives. You can check it out and come to your own conclusion, or you can get the book. And Zora Neale Hurston, in addition to being a fiction author, she was an anthropologist. That's why I questioned, her credentials to put together a scientific book are pretty solid. Allegations of plagiarism aside, her credentials for a scientific piece are pretty impeccable.
Well, was this the only one? Is there any other similar?
There's a group of, there's like a massive anthology. It's referenced in Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, where they went around and talked to former slaves. Now, I'm not sure if any of those folks had been through the Middle Passage, but they went around and collected tons of narratives. It would just be...
Yeah, I'm aware of that one. That's why I was specifically talking about any other victims other than this person who actually was on the voyages.
Oh, Olato Equiano, that's one. We talked about him in Vincent... Oh, I can't believe it. Delectable Negro. There we go. Olato Equiano. That's one. That's a very popular one where he was very young and wrote about his experience going through the Middle Passage. I think there are a few others. That's one right off the top. We talked about that one before on the program. Olato Equiano.
Okay. Okay.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
To retire firefighter's point, I remember there was a African slave named Abdul Rahman, who used to be a slave for John Quincy Adams. He was actually a prince in Africa somewhere, and he has an autobiography. I think it might be in the Library of Congress, but that's a name that you probably might want to look up.
Okay.
I'm sure there are some others as well. I'm looking online. That's if folks have. Let's see. Yeah, I'll check online, and then I'll share tomorrow our post as I find others. But it seems like there probably are a few others where it's actually a black person who went through the Middle Passage, and then they got a story written about their life.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to make a comment about what you said about people who say the black people are cowards and that's why we're still in this situation. The reality of it is that we've been, you know, terrorized, and it's only logical to comply with terrorists. I mean, they did that on, you know, 9/11 and in so many other instances. And yes, the vast majority of, you know, black people have not refused, I guess, to comply with terrorists, and that goes for every other group. But the thing is, the people who didn't comply with terrorists, they didn't sit around, and I don't say this, and I somewhat hesitate to say this because I don't want to speak negatively about other victims or speak in a way that promotes conflict between other victims. However, the people who did not comply with terrorists, like Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Lavelle Mixon and Mark Essex and a bunch of other people, they didn't sit around complaining about other people not doing this or that. So these people who are saying this, it's like, okay, well, what are you doing? Just like Pam the Great, she mentioned this. You know, what are you doing or what have you done? I mean, ultimately, I would imagine that the reason you're not in greater confinement or in the grave is because what you're saying is that you can't find anybody, I guess, that will organize with you to, you know, take it to these race soldiers. But the people who didn't comply with the terrorists, they didn't sit around and wait for that. They went and, you know, did whatever it was that they were going to do. So it's like, ultimately, you're just talking. So my thing is this, what makes you any different from us? That you are not doing anything either. You are proving that you are just as afraid as we are. And I would even go so far as to say this, that you are even just as logical as we are. That isn't to say that the people who didn't comply with the terrorists, that they are illogical. No, it is logical to do either, to fight for your freedom in those ways, or to, you know, be afraid and be concerned about your immediate preservation and your immediate survival. So that's, you know, that was all I had. I'll move on.
Right on. It looks like they have quite a few different books that are, this is a very popular genre, or was a very popular genre in terms of books written by or about individuals who have been enslaved. So if you go to Wikipedia's page for Olato Equiano and then look at the bottom, there's a huge section, which I thought it would be, that gives, like, this is a genre of books, narratives about these type of folks who've been enslaved. And you can just scroll down there and wade through and pick out the ones that are older, like the early 1800s and that era, and pick out the ones that, you know, look like these might be someone who actually was on the Middle Passage, to see if there are others from that era. I have to go through myself and pick out a few to see which ones. John Andrew Jackson was born on, his father was, but yeah, just have to go through and pick out which ones and see if you can nab one from a person who was either on the Middle Passage or where they were. Just kind of, oh, they made it so easy, you can just kind of mouse over and the information will pop up. So you'll be able to see immediately where the person was born at. Oh, I found one. Pierre Toussaint, that's one where you can nab some information about him. I think they have some books about him. Just go through and pick out and see if you find any that stick out or resonate. Any other folks have question, thought they need to get in?
Yes, Gus, I wanted to say one last thing. I think you were on to something with that part of Ruby McCollum. It seems that you know, that case went all the way to Supreme Court, and I think she was a wealthy black woman, and it was, you know, white men would just do what they wanted to do to the black women at that time, and then, you know, I guess whatever happened, and then it was a question of rights, you know, what she had the right to defend herself. So I'd be, you know, interested to find out more about that. And how I think in context where Zola Neale Hurston trusted this William Hugh or whoever, because she thought that he would collaborate with her in writing on that case. And then he double-crossed her, of course, you know, wouldn't. Took all her information and made it his own. And I think she asked him for a little transportation to come up to the trial, which would have just been pocket change for him, and he refused to do that. So it's the same story over and over. I think that's an interesting thing to pursue, though. But thanks, Dustin. I'll mute my line.
For sure. I'm going to make that my Monday project at the library. I might even, I can make that double duty. I can go to the library and then I can go rowing. Seattle is so cool. The University of Washington is right on the lake, and you can just walk from the library, go out and do some rowing. Anything else folks need to get in?
They did a great job with the narration on this one, and the warmth of other sons. I mean, I like the way that she did the dialect and things like that, and just, you know, just how she narrates in general. That was it.
Robin Miles, excellent job. Not Joe Morton, but outstanding work. And hopefully we'll have outstanding narration from one of our listeners beginning next week with Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. We will be starting that in honor of Pam. Hopefully someone has the time and energy. I know that is it is labor. I have done that myself many times over. It certainly is labor. I would be tickled to do it this time, but don't think I could stay composed to get through it for the duration. So if any folks think they would be able, drop me an email and let me know. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. The shock is just now hitting me. For the last 2 months, every Friday at this time, I have been at teacher training. It is just sinking in. This is the first time in 2 months that at this time I am not at teacher training. Thank God. Woo! With that, tomorrow we will be here for the compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We will catch up on what has gone down over the last week, observations, questions, suggestions. We'll get Ivy's question that she wanted to pose today. We'll get that tomorrow as well. And other thoughts, tune in, looking forward to it. Thanks to everyone for participating in the book club. I hope it was worthy of your Friday evening. Should be in the archives post haste. Again, reading is more important than watching television. Dr. Welsing certainly encouraged that. If you have other suggestions for the book club, let me know. We'll get to it after Pam, although I'm very intrigued about that Ruby McCollum situation. If I was able to get my hands on that book, woof, that one would be waiting for whenever we get done with Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. That's the one that we would be waiting to read. Anywho, again, I know summer's winding down. If you want to be out, frolic, have fun, great, enjoy. I will be out rowing myself on Monday. That said, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Racists, they do not pause just because the weather is nice. We still want to be codified, attempted counter-racist soldiers. Let's make sure that we can use our brain computer as best we can to make phenomenal decisions on the system of white supremacy. In that same vein, out and about in a vehicle, let us be sober and buckled up every single time. Driver or passenger, let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.